Session number 3119, Belson, 50 years on, with Lord Runcie, Mrs. Wallfish, and John Sandberg.
We're particularly grateful to the Right Reverend Lord Runcie for finding time to be with us today in what I know is an extremely busy schedule.
My lords, ladies and gentlemen, it's an honour to be invited to address such a gathering. And in your presence, I feel largely unqualified. I only wish that I could stay for the whole session. I have another engagement which compels me to leave. But I couldn't turn down an invitation to say a few words to you about Belson. 50 years ago today, a day like this, sunny, blossom on the trees, I was a young officer, a tank commander, and we were fighting in the outskirts of Celle, just over 12 miles from Belson. It was one of the last engagements of the war for us. Celle seemed such a civilized place, and yet the fighting was quite sharp. When we established ourselves there, it was a shock to discover that in this charming town, externally, there was a dreadful, small concentration camp. And that was where the first horror struck us as we discovered starving people, people with their thumbs screwed off, and people who'd been scalped. It was something we'd not encountered before, and I remember that our reaction in the organization was to make some of the senior people in the administration of the town responsible for taking the sick and carrying them into the large and very well equipped local hospital. But news of what had been discovered at Belson in much greater proportion drifted to us, so that when there was a moment, a breathing space, some of us set off in a jeep. I remember we loaded the jeep with toys and sweets for the children. In retrospect, how well-meaning, but how pathetic it was, having regard to the scale and horror of what we encountered. It was 8 days, 10 days after the liberation of Belson. We cannot in any way, I cannot in any way claim the experience of some of the people who will subsequently talk to us. And I confess that I didn't have the stomach to do a full tour. In any case, tourism was not welcome. But the whole atmosphere and the stench and the ghost-like figures and what we did see was quite enough for me to validate all that had been said in the initial and famous report of Richard Dimbleby, and also has given me this sentence, which I never fail to include when I'm put on the spot on interviews and asked about being a soldier and what I feel now about fighting in the war. I say, a war that closed down Belsen was a war worth fighting. After the war, I spent some of my education on purpose at a German university, a place where I was very happy, made many friends, and where I discovered the debt that Europe owes to the scholarship and the culture and the scientific achievements that emanated from Germany, from the music of Bach, the poetry of Rilke. But it burnt into me this, which for me is one of the great ethical questions of the century, a century of many ethical conundrums, and that is how a people so culturally and scientifically advanced could allow something to happen which plunged us back into barbarism unimaginable. That is the great conundrum for me about the Holocaust, that makes it different from the dreadful scenes, perhaps, of tribal warfare of less advanced people. It's the contrast between the cultural and scientific achievement and the depravity and barbarism. Of course, it means for me that there is no future for any religious or moral studies which does not put in the center the fact that irrational attitudes to people who are unlike us can become unstoppable. Irrational attitudes to people who are unlike us can become unstoppable. But I still think that Holocaust studies are unique and necessary. We need to remember and recall and tell the story in all its complexity. Now that seems to me important, because it was the telling of simple stories about the past which enabled the telling of simple lies about the present to be fatally effective in blinding the eyes of good, decent, civilized people that I knew. allowing yourself to be at the mercy of simplicities about the past, can enable evil people to get away with fatal lies about the present. Well, that's perhaps rather a brief mixture of memory and moralizing. There is a poem among the war poems that were written during the last war, the last 1418 war, the last 39-45 war. And it's called Belson. And each stanza ends with the lines, "And the armored divisions drove on." Well, I'm afraid that I was among the armored divisions that drove on, because we scented victory and we were going to enjoy it to the full. But 50 years on, when in old age you see things a bit more in perspective, it's Belson that I chiefly remember for realism and determination that such things shall not happen again.
I have received this morning a message from the President of the Board of Deputies of British Jews, who is very sorry he couldn't be with us today, but he has sent the following message. The Board of Deputies of British Jews is honoured to be associated with this historic commemoration. Through the Yad Vashem Committee of the Board, under the chairmanship of the indefatigable Ben Helfgott, the Jewish community has been proud to participate in the arrangements for this significant anniversary. We pay tribute to the Imperial War Museum for having done so much in recent years to highlight the evils of Belsen, as well as for hosting this remarkable occasion. We also express our appreciation to the efforts of the other organizations involved, namely the Stanley Burton Center for Holocaust Studies, the Holocaust Education Trust, 45 Aid Society, and the Polish Jewish Ex-Servicemen's Association. Today, the Jewish community of Britain pays tribute to all those who experienced at first hand the evil that was Belsen. As citizens of Britain, we cherish the efforts of those of our fellow countrymen who did their utmost to save the lives of those left in the camp when the Nazis departed. As Jews, we express with humility our empathy with all those who survived the experience and our admiration for those who have had the courage and fortitude to join us today. They all display living proof of the reality of the Holocaust. Their presence here today provides the clearest possible evidence that the lies of those who seek to deny the Holocaust are false and base. On the eve of the great Jewish festival of freedom, the Passover, it is fitting to pay tribute to all those who are here today, whether as liberators or liberated, along with those who perished in Belsen and those who have not been able to join us for this commemoration. This Friday night, throughout the world, Jewish people will be thanking the Almighty who has delivered us from slavery to freedom, from sorrow to joy, from mourning to a festival, from darkness to a great light, from servitude to redemption. There can be no clearer recognition of the debt owed to those who helped us to put an end to the evil empire of Nazi Germany and our confidence in the ultimate triumph of good over evil. We now move to the main part of the commemoration. And as you've heard, in the spring of 1945, the German army was forced onto the defensive by the twin onslaughts of the British and American forces in the West and the Red Army in the East. As the noose tightened, the Nazis made every effort to clear and conceal the concentration camps, removing their exhausted, sick, and dying inhabitants. some of the remnants found their way to Belsen. The facilities there were totally unable to cope with this influx, and basic services, food, water, and sanitation, swiftly collapsed. Diseases, principally typhus, dysentery, and tuberculosis, soon reached epidemic proportions. Some bare statistics give an idea of the scale of the overcrowding problem. An official census at the end of 1944 showed that there were just over 15,000 prisoners in Bergen-Belsen camp, which had incidentally been built for a little more than 2,000. By February, the transports from the east had caused this to rise to 22,000. By March, it had swollen to over 41,000, over 18,000 of whom died during that month. And by April 1945, the number of prisoners had reached a staggering 60,000. One of those prisoners is our first speaker. Mrs. Anita Lasker-Walfisch is a cellist of international renown and a founding member of the English Chamber Orchestra. She was a young music student living with her parents and sisters in Breslau when the war broke out. Arrested by the Gestapo for their resistance activities, she and her sister were imprisoned, first in a civil prison but later deported to Auschwitz. There, Mrs. Lasker-Walfisch was recruited into the camp orchestra, her talent thereby saving her life. With the Russian advance, she was sent in a cattle truck to Bergen-Belsen, where she now takes up the story.
By the time I arrived in Belsen, I was 17 years old and pretty much a vintage prisoner with a great deal of experience. I had behind me over a year in prison and miraculously survived a year in Auschwitz-Birkenau. I will briefly tell you how I came to be in these auspicious places. I'm sure you're all familiar with the events which led to the Wannsee Conference, where a few people of pure Aryan race decided in a matter-of-fact fashion that the Jewish race must and will be eliminated in its entirety. I believe the meeting lasted 1 hour and a half. I was born in Breslau, which was German at the time and is Polish now, and my background is typical Jewish middle class. My father was a lawyer, my mother a violinist, and I had two sisters. We were a very happy family. The clouds gathered in the 30s with all the implications which I don't have to go into here. All efforts to immigrate failed dismally, partly because they were probably started too late, but mainly because of the unsurmountable difficulties which were made by the governments of countries which might have saved my parents from their ultimate fate. In the archives of this very building lies the correspondence between my father and my eldest sister, who had escaped by then. They are testimony to my father's hopes, despair, and final defeat. I'm afraid they include refusals from the Home Office. The inevitable happened. My parents were deported on the 9th of April, 1942, and they were never heard of again. At that time, I was working in a paper factory making toilet rolls. My sister and I were arrested by the Gestapo in the same year, sent to prison because we had been trying to escape with forged papers to the unoccupied zone of France. We had a trial for forgery, helping the enemy and attempted escape. After a year in prison, I was sent to Auschwitz, and after a year in Auschwitz, we were sent to Belsen. In Auschwitz, I had the great good fortune to be a member of the camp orchestra. We had no information about events outside the camp and had no conception about how the war was going. I think it was the beginning of November when the dreaded moment came. We were ordered to line up, Jews to one side, Aryans to the other. This could only mean one thing, the gas chamber. But it transpired that we were not going to be gassed, but believe it or not, we were going to be sent to another camp. To leave Auschwitz, not by way of the chimney, but actually put distance between oneself and this murder factory, seemed nothing short of a miracle. Of course, we did not know then what was awaiting us at our destination. We were issued with different clothes, in other words, all the relatively acceptable garments which we had managed to organize by then were taken away from us, and we were given some really atrocious outfits, certainly most inadequate for the temperatures of the time of year. With great cunning, I managed to retain my red jumper, which I had been wearing day and night in Auschwitz. I wore it day and night until the liberation, some 6 months later, and you can see it now, what is left of it, in this building. We were loaded into a cattle truck and began our journey westwards. Some rumors had gone about that we were going to be taken to a convalescent camp. It was called Bergen-Belsen. Nobody had ever heard of it. We were no longer an orchestra, of course, but we were a group of people who had already survived against impossible odds, and it was obvious from the beginning that we were going to stick together, come what may. And that was the first recipe for survival, to stick together, not to be alone. One day the train stopped, and we were ordered to get out with the usual schnell, schnell, schnell. We were at a small station, and there was not a living soul about. We were ordered to group ourselves in rows of five and started marching. We marched for a considerable time, and to our dismay, we heard continuous shooting. Then we passed a sign which read, "Zum Judenschießstand." In the Gothic script, I misread it as Judenschießstand and was sure that this was exactly where we were going. I was marching in the front row, and one of the things which I clearly remember was that I was glad that I was going to be shot first and that I will not have to see my sister and my friends being killed. However, we kept marching and no one shot us. And we stopped at the entrance of the camp. Now, Belsen did not look then what you have come to know now. We did not see heaps and heaps of corpses then. That was yet to come. We just stood there and saw some disheveled creatures milling about. And we saw someone with a capo armband scraping out an obviously empty soup vat. My sister remarked dryly, "If a capo needs to do that, things must be pretty bad here." Well, things were pretty bad, but not as bad as they were to become yet. We entered the camp, and it was soon evident that there just simply was no room for us. I think we were some 3,000 people on our transport, and there were no barracks there for us. So we were all herded into vast tents. We were completely exhausted and just flopped down on the bare earth, and there we sat for days, waiting for God knows what. And then came the famous storm, and the tents collapsed on top of us in the middle of the night. How we survived that night, I shall never understand. Somehow we managed to scramble free and just stood there in the middle of the night in the pouring rain and howling gale. And the next morning we were led to a shoe bunker and remained there for some days. We hardly had any room to move, but we were happy to have a roof over our heads. And then suddenly and inexplicably, there were empty barracks available for us. We shall never know how this was achieved, but we all had our suspicions. After some weeks of sitting around and doing nothing, we were put to work in what was called the Weberei. We made a sort of ersatz rope by plaiting strips of cellophane. And then I remember the first body in our block. I helped remove it. And then the death marchers started to arrive. This was a sight which is not possible to describe, just simply because there are no words in any vocabulary to come anywhere near it. The sight of dead bodies became so commonplace that one just simply ignored them. The watery so-called soup which we got became irregular and eventually stopped altogether. Typhus raged and people dropped dead like flies. The mountains of unburied corpses grew higher and higher, and nobody could deal with them. We were made to drag the corpses to the end of the camp out of the way, so to speak. we tied string around the hands and tried to drag them along the Lagerstraße. This exercise, however, did not last long. We were too weak and one just could not keep up with the ever-growing mountains of corpses. By now it was April and very hot. We had stopped freezing, but now we had another hazard. The corpses were decomposing, and the stench must have been horrendous. We did not notice it. And then one day, it was April, there was a lot of noise coming from outside the camp. We had a feeling that something unusual was happening, but we had no idea what it was. We saw fewer and fewer guards and felt somehow that the end must be near. But what this end would be, we could not know. All I remember now is that we greatly feared that the Germans would blow up the camp before it was liberated. Some people said that the rumbling noises outside the camp might be tanks belonging to the Allies. I didn't want to hear that, and I was furious most of the time. I could not face any disappointment. I was more familiar with thoughts of death than with thoughts of a possible liberation. But then it actually happened. I was very weak by then, and my sister tells me that she dragged me outside the block and that we sat down on the ground, surrounded by corpses, and waited. And there it was. The first British vehicle rolled into the camp, and the nightmare had come to an end. Thank you.
In bronze, Winston Churchill, who inspired us to that victory, which we commemorate this year. And I point out to them, too, the memorial arch beside the statue, unrestored and battered and bruised to this day, a permanent reminder of the suffering of the conflict. And whenever I do that, two thoughts always come to my mind. The first is that that generation, those school children, those young people, have no experience and no memory and no recollection of the horror which we have heard so movingly described to us this morning. And the second thought is that I am forcibly reminded that it was but an accident of fate that brought my own grandfather from a little Lithuanian village of Pilviski at the end of the last century to this country and to a new life of freedom. And that enabled him to survive a terrible massacre in that village in 1942, where the whole Jewish community was done to death in a single night, and all that remains, for I have seen it, are two mass graves. Now I believe, ladies and gentlemen, that we have a duty. Those who survived Belsen and Auschwitz and all the other places, those precious few, and those of us who liberated, who brought freedom, who brought an end to the suffering, and those of us who by geography and accident of birth were left untouched by war, all of us have a duty to educate those school children and those young people, to tell them what happened, to tell them why it happened, to tell them that it could be repeated if we ever allow racism and anti-Semitism to gain a foothold. We have a duty, all of us, to honor the memory of those who perished, who passed on to us a solemn injunction to remember, never, ever to forget. And if we do that, never forget and always remember, we will ensure that the Holocaust will never, ever happen again.